Welcome to the Riverside Project podcast. We are mobilizing Houston to empower families and transform generations. We hope these conversations will give you a greater understanding of the issues facing our community and inspire you to find your place along the river.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Riverside Project podcast. Today, we have two ladies that I've gotten to know a little bit from Decatur, Texas. Usually we have Houstonians on this podcast, but I'm really excited to get some voices from some lovely ladies who are out of town. We have Catherine Venata here today. She is a senior data analyst in oil and gas and also a mom of two boys. She lived in Houston for about 15 years before moving to Decatur, Texas, and she's been serving there as a CASA advocate for the last 3 years. Excited to talk with her about her experience there. And then we also have Tiffany Magritte. She is the founder and executive director of One Hope Village there in Decatur, Texas as well. She is also a mom of two grown girls and a new grandmother as well. And she, before she founded One Hope Village, she served as a school teacher for over 20 years. So, and also, I guess, as a CASA advocate as well. So I'm really excited for you to hear a little bit about their story. And yeah, I'm glad that you guys are here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
Great. Well, Catherine, just start off sharing a little bit about your journey into being a CASA advocate, how you got there, and just that journey even into Decatur, Texas.
Yeah, for sure. So I have been involved in different facets of foster care, CPS, et cetera, for the last 10, 15 years. I've always had a heart for children in tough places. And so I've gone through foster care trainings to become foster care parents. Just really love loving on those kids from hard places. And so when we relocated to Decatur about 3 years ago, I really realized what a huge need Wise County had for anything and everything. And so at that time, we weren't really able to foster, but I decided to plug in as a CASA. And so CASA has really opened my eyes to a different side of what goes on in the foster care world as a whole, because there are so many different facets and so many different things that happen and nuances here and there. And it's not just like, oh, we need people that will take care of these kids for a few years or in perpetuity and adopt them or whatever that looks like. There are so many different things going on. We need mentors. We need, you know, we need counselors. And there's such a need across the board. And CASA really gave me an overview of what that looks like, kind of a bird's eye view. And so for the last 3 years, I've had, I think, 5 cases total. And so I've been able to see, you know, every case is different. Everything looks different. All of the people are different every time. And so you really learn the good and the bad and the ugly of the court system and CPS and anything and everything in between.
That's great. I want to dive into a little bit more about that story. I want to also just introduce Tiffany, share a little bit about how you got started with One Hope Village and just the journey that you took to get there.
Yeah, so I'm going to kind of back into growing up. I grew up in a pretty volatile home. So for me, I didn't have a great example of what kind of normal life was like. I went to college. I was the first one to go to college. Became a school teacher. I have always taught in Title I districts, so very low income districts. I thought that's where God wanted me to be. I was supposed to be in those districts, working with those children, and he just continued to set things up. I stepped away from the public school environment about 10 years after being in it. My heart was just breaking. It just wasn't where I was supposed to be. So I became I taught for the private sector for a little while. And then we actually homeschooled also for our youngest daughters from fourth grade on. And one of the things that I learned in every one of those positions is that we were not meeting the needs of children, but more importantly, we weren't meeting the needs of families. And so I became a CASA supervisor about 2.5 years ago. And there was a lot of friction. What I felt was friction, and it was just God rubbing me saying, hey, I need you to open your eyes because I've kept putting you in different positions. And now I need you to look at the parents, because if you're going to help the children, you have to help the parents. And they're falling through the cracks right and left. And so I just started pouring into parents and really seeing that if we're going to keep putting children back into the homes we took them out of, we have to help change the trajectories of those homes. And so that's kind of where One Hope Village was born from. And also, honestly, a fight with God. So like, surely not me, surely not me. And he just kept saying, you're going to do this. And it's been really cool to watch.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that both of you have or have had careers that weren't necessarily in the foster care space. And seeing this burden, that what starts off as a burden to see stability in the community, that kind of catapults you into this, either serving as a CASA advocate, serving as a CASA supervisor, or even starting an entire nonprofit to fill in a gap that didn't really, where nothing really existed before. So gosh, kudos to both of you for just having the courage and the bravery to step in and meet those needs. So Catherine, I want to go back a little bit to share, you know, we've known each other for a long time. When you were in Houston, we were connected. And I remember having conversations with you about, with you and your husband wanting to get licensed to be a foster parent, and that door kept closing. Can you share a little bit about, it's like you had an idea of how you would serve in the foster care space and that door kept closing. And yet you kind of just kept pushing through and found a spot. Share a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So our first, we'll say attempt at fostering, we were in Houston. Our son Oliver was 2. And yeah, you and I actually met and just kind of, I was like, tell me everything. What do I need to know? What should I be looking for? Is this something, you know, that we can handle? Tell me everything. Because, you know, firsthand, you can Google everything all you want, but firsthand experience goes a long way. And so, you know, we had a great conversation, and John Reed and I decided to go ahead and go through with the foster training. And we actually, as you know, there's a lot that goes into that. We did all of the classes and all the paperwork, everything that needed to be done. And we were up to the home study point, and John Reed was diagnosed with testicular cancer. And so they were basically like, nope, we don't want you to be foster parents. You have a lot going on. And we were just like, but this, I mean, a lot of people probably don't know testicular cancer. I don't want to say isn't that big of a deal, but it's something, it's like if you're going to get a cancer, that is the one sure. to get. And so essentially he had surgery, had it removed, and has been perfect ever since. He has to do MRIs and things like that to follow up every year. But the agency we were going through was like, no, you guys need to focus on his health. You don't need to be taking on foster care right now, and really like slammed the door for us. And we were kind of like, well, what do we do now? Because we had staked, you know, a year of time and life into that. And it was really kind of heart-wrenching because we had put so much into it. But ultimately, God had another plan for us. And our son Theo was born about a year later. So he's our hot mess express and a blast. And is Tiffany's favorite? Well, Tiffany is his favorite person ever. I don't know if it's the other way around. That's just kind of where we landed. And then we've also walked through that. We tried again when we first got up here to North Texas to go through another agency. And my father passed away and left just a mess of an estate for me to settle. And it took a whole entire year to settle that estate. And we really just prayed about it. We decided to, you know, just put everything on hold again. And that's when I was like, okay, I can handle doing CASA, because that's something, you know, that is not full time. It's something that we can make work. Going back to becoming a CASA, I really prayed about how to really, my prayer was to open John Reed's eyes to teen boys and what a need that is, because he's like a phenomenal man. My husband's amazing. And I really wanted him to be able to mentor and help plug in with boys that just don't have a father. And so my first case was actually he was like 12 at the time. And he was living in an RTC down in Houston and had been in and out of the foster care system from basically the time of birth. Lots of different cases, but essentially at the age of 7 was adopted out of foster care. And so often, you know, people give themselves a pat on the back. Cool, the case is closed and life moves on. But that is not at all what happened. And there was a lot of issues with his adoptive family, and his adoptive family ended up basically surrendering him because they couldn't handle or weren't willing to work through his traumas and get him the help that he needed. And so Tiffany was actually my supervisor on this case. And it was like, I was thinking through it last night as I was thinking about things to talk about, and it was just heartbreaking. Over and over again, we see these kids that come back into care because people are ill-equipped to deal with their needs. And so it's not only the initial trauma of removal and separation from families, but the no one wants me, no one cares. And that, like, they feel that way for a reason. My first visit to the, sorry, I might cry talking about this. My first visit to the RTC was, it was Christmas Eve. And like, I remember walking in, there's no decorations, no Christmas trees. Anyway, it was devoid of love. And I remember telling Tiffany, like, we got to get this kid out of here. And it was really eye-opening because he was one of like 45 boys there. And I was the only one there Christmas Eve visiting him. And I was the only one that cared. And there are staff members, there are people paid to be there to care. But that is not the same as a family. And I remember talking to Tiffany and being like, there are RTCs all over the state. What are we doing to these children? There's a reason why the system is broken. There's a reason why so many of these boys go on to become men who offend. Because and this was apparently one of the good RTCs. And there were 8 boys in a room. There was a room monitor outside. And their job was to make sure that no fights broke out. And that's what it was. And I remember talking to the kiddo that I represented, and he was like, yeah, my best friend is in here with me. And I was like, awesome. Like, when did y'all become friends? And he was like, we were in a foster home together when we were 5. And I was just like, it's been 10 years and you've been adopted since then. And just the like enormity of the brokenness of the situation is still heartbreaking. And so his story has a really happy ending. And sorry, I've like hijacked everything for this moment.
Share what happened moving forward.
Yeah, so Tiffany and I, with the CASA supervisor, you have a monthly meeting. And you sit down and you're like, what can we do to advocate best for this child? And you bounce ideas off each other and you make a game plan. And there's not a lot of game plan happening from my experience on the CPS side. They're just keeping up with all of their to-do lists, checking things off the list. There's not a lot of forward progress, especially in a 14-year-old boy's case, right? Like, he's in an RTC. That's where he's going to be. And so we initially advocated to get him into a foster home. And we were like, we've got to get him out of here. He doesn't have any behavioral issues. We got to get him out of here. And he was saying, I want to be out of here. Why am I here? And so we did a couple things. First of all, we got him into public school again. And that was something I have learned and has been the most frustrating thing about being in CASA. All you have to do is ask the question and things happen. And so I asked his CPS worker, I was like, how do we get him into school? And she's like, oh, I just send over a piece of paper and he's enrolled. And I was like, why have we been pulling teeth for 3 months? He's been saying he wants to go to public school. Why haven't we done this for this child? Like, it's a reward for good behavior, right? Why haven't we given him the outside world? And so we enrolled him in public school. And then the next thing was, okay, we're going to get his level of care reduced. So he is forced out of the RTC. And so we started doing all of the psychological things that have to be done to get his level of care reduced. And then about that time, I was really praying through, like, what else can we do? It clicked. I was like, he has been out of foster care from the time he entered care, or 7 years has passed since the time he entered care. Surely there's someone.
You're saying the second time he entered care.
He was like 5 to 7 the very first time he was removed. And then I think he was about 7 when he was adopted. And so it, like 7 years have passed. And I talked to Tiffany and I was like, there has to be family members out there that have gotten clean, gotten sober, that CPS missed the first time, a cousin that has become an adult. Someone, right? 7 years has passed and a lot, that's huge. And so she was like, start poking at that. And she really encouraged me to dig into that. And so I messaged CPS. CPS was not helpful. I talked to the kiddo. I was like, do you happen to remember your last name before you were adopted? And he told me his last name. And I knew that it was in this like small county that he had been removed from. And the last name was unique. And so I literally got on Facebook and looked up his last name and was like, all right, there are people in Wise County with this last name that kind of look like him. And so I messaged Tiffany. I was like, am I overstepping boundaries if I start sending random Facebook messages asking these people if they know this child? And she was like, run it by CPS and start doing it. And so I messaged CPS, no response. And I started sending random Facebook messages. Hey, do you remember a kid that might have been, you know, removed by CPS? Like the weirdest messages I have ever sent in my life. But the worst, you know, someone would say is no. And so by this time, something else I did, because he was so frustrated and he was just a ticking time bomb. And I talked to him. He was like, I need to talk to someone about getting out of here. And I was like, yes, you do. I'm going to talk to your attorney and have you set up an appointment with the judge. And I felt like that would at least make him feel heard, having someone of importance hear him out. And our judge in Wise County is phenomenal. And so she heard him and like her heart broke for him. And we had a hearing a week or two afterwards. And she basically told CPS that she was going to order them to do jail time if they did not do what they were supposed to be doing on this case, because they had really just dropped the ball left and right. And so literally the next day, CPS was in my house with a list of biological family members. And we went through the list and called all of them. And we found a grandmother who had gotten clean in hopes that if anything ever happened, she'd be able to take her grandson. And so, long story short, he's placed with her. He's been there almost a year now, and things are going well. It's not perfect, but it is a happy ending. he's with family, and it's a good family. It's his dad's side of the family, which was never even really looked into for adoption when he was initially removed. Dad was just written off as like a bad guy, and they looked at mom's family. Mom's family was a mess, and they put him up for adoption, basically. And so, I mean, we can see like this has been a 7 to 9 year really tumultuous life for this kid. And that story is not unique. This one has a good ending, but most of them don't. And that is the reality that we see a lot of, and was just really eye opening. Seeing all the kids in the RTC and everything that goes along with that.
It's interesting to see so many different people who are involved with him that do have an opportunity to look deeper, to find, you know, to really go above and beyond. You know, there are RTC workers and there's caseworkers and there's an ad litem attorney and there's a judge and there's a CASA advocate. And the sad thing and the frustrating thing I think that you're speaking to is there are so many people who have responsibility. And the reality is not everyone takes that responsibility or just doesn't have the capacity to take on that responsibility because there's so many people on their caseload and there's, you know, all the other things going on. And it does take sometimes just one person willing to say, I'll take a risk, I'll take a step. I'm not willing to just say that there's no hope or there's no option or solution here. Tell me a little bit more about just Wise County in general. So you mentioned lots of, you know, last time we talked, the challenges that happened in Wise County that influenced the story for this kid is not really unique, right? There are lots and lots of needs. Can you speak to that? And Tiffany, feel free to jump in too, just because I want to know how you move from CASA advocate to CASA supervisor to starting this nonprofit. And I think those kind of things are very intertwined, right?
So as Catherine said, here in Wise County, we're very rural. So one of the things that we do not have is resources. How I kind of transitioned was parents are coming to the system. Their children are removed. So we're not looking at the trauma that's happening to the parents. We wrap a lot of services around the children, which is not wrong. But what we're doing is we're handing parents a legal document that's 20 to 30 pages long. I say we collectively, our organization is at CPS, and saying, hey, you have 1 year to go figure your life out. Most of our families they're still addicted to drugs and they have mental health issues at this point. And the backup, you know, that mama and that daddy, they didn't wake up one day and say, hey, I'm going to become an addict and neglect my child. In Wise County specifically, this happens at a very young age. Most of the time we're seeing between 9 and 12, they started using with their parents or their grandparents or their family. So it's a trajectory thing within generations that has to be changed. So when the child's removed, they're sent to foster care. Wise County, we have about 20 foster homes, if that, at this time. So all of the children taken out of homes in Wise County, they're placed all over the state. And I've actually had children placed in other states. So now the parent doesn't know where the child is. They're still addicted. They're still facing mental health issues. And they're given this document and said, hey, go figure your life out in a year. Good luck. We're going to take care of the child. So the parents continue to spiral downward. They don't have anyone to turn to. And sadly, here in Wise County, our CPS turnover is crazy. We typically don't have a caseworker, honestly, longer than 6 months. So the documentation gets lost. The parent has to start all over again. They don't have the support. So one of the things that I saw happening with CASA is those parents are out there struggling. They are in the trenches. Many of them living in their cars. We don't have drug testing in Wise County. We don't have parenting classes in Wise County. So they're having to go to neighboring counties, which are 30, 40 minutes away. Well, their cars are broke down. They don't have gas money. So transportation is a huge issue. They don't get to the drug test on time, then it's an automatic failed drug test. So there's a whole lot of challenges right in the middle of their way. So one of the things that I saw that just kept happening, and they had no one to turn to. And I'm a bit of a rebel in a lot of things. I used to get in trouble when I was teaching a lot because I would help the kids more than I should. And that's one of the things. CAUSE is a great program. When CAUSE does what CAUSE is intended to do, we're intended to help the child, the best interest of the child. And at the heart of the day, the best interest of the child is to be with biological family if that is a safe option. So it is our job to help the parents as much as we're helping the children. And for me, that wasn't happening. So One Hope Village was placed on my heart, just those three words. And so I started talking to attorneys, and like Catherine said, our judge in West County is phenomenal. She switched us 2 years ago to a trauma-informed court. So we are less adversarial and we're more of a village style. And I talked to a judge telling her all about what I wanted to do to help parents. And a week and a half later, our judge came to us like, hey, I need to talk to you. And I didn't know her really well other than working with her. And I thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? I'm in trouble. The judge wants to see me. And she said, let's have lunch. And I was like, oh man, you know, you don't have lunch with judges all the time. So I was like, okay. And so sat down and she was like, hey, Dana told me what you have on your heart. Tell me about it. And I did. And she was like, okay, what do we need to do? And we started talking, and the Children's Commission has been absolutely amazing. They put us in contact with an organization out of Houston that's similar to what we do. They have one parent mentor under them. So essentially what One Hope Village has done is we have taken parents that have come successfully out of the child protective courts. This means that they have completed all of their services. They didn't just check boxes, but they literally made changes to their life and the trajectory of their families. And they were reunited with their children. Now we have our mentors range from parents that have been out of the system for 7 years to parents that have been out of the system for 1 year. What we do is we train them, prepare them, and I put them back into the system as a mentor for a family that's coming along the system right now. So if it's a mother, we put her with a mother that's going through the system right now. We handle drug and mental health cases. And so all of our mentors have had those experiences. And it has been really, really cool to watch that. We have two male mentors and five female mentors. And the male ones, to me, they're just a little more, I'm going to say important because I don't want my females to hear that, but dads tend to walk away and they get out easy. The males that we have right now, they're absolutely amazing. They grab a hold of those dads and say, hey, you have to stay in this site for your family. And one of the coolest things I have seen happen that I didn't really think of, and we've had this conversation a lot within our board, the mentors had to step away from everything. They're the ones that came through the system successful. They stepped away from family, friends, all of those. And they have a family now within the mentors. And to me, that is just one of the coolest things.
Yeah.
And so we get to take parents and walk alongside them. And at the beginning, it's really hard getting them to trust us. We get, are you CPS? Are you, CAUSE? And I'm always like, no, we're Switzerland. We are here for you. We only work with the parent and the attorney. And how we get parents is attorneys refer them to us. And so we only communicate with the parent and the attorney. And sometimes it's hard to get the trust, but then they meet the mentor that's been there.
Right.
And it's like, oh.
The lived experience.
Exactly. You do hear me and you do see me. And my husband and I, we have an addiction story, but we don't have the CPS side of it. So just putting us all together, and we run a kind of a three-tiered system. We have the parent, and then we have the mentors on me with them, and then we have leaders over that. So we have an amazing wealth of knowledge, and resources are the hardest part for us. So we help them find resources. Out of the box style resources. One of the things they don't realize is in that CPS system, if they're told they have to go to NA or AA, but that's not where they feel called, like Celebrate Recovery might be better for them. So we help go to the attorney and petition to have that service plan changed so it can be tailored to fit the parent and the needs. And then we also find extra resources. We had amazing people come to us, parent coaches, financial coaches that say, hey, let us in there, let us help these parents. And so that's been really cool to watch happen too.
Yeah, that's so good. And support for biological families is so scarce. No matter if you live in a rural county or an urban county, it seems like, of course, it's always, we assume that because like I live in Houston, that there would be more supports, and there typically are generally more supports, but I think those prevention efforts are really coming around the biological family. It's like once they have a CPS case, it's the posture is often we demonize them. They are the enemy. They are the worst. And yet so few people are saying, what is it that you really need and how do we come alongside you to get your family back together? I think that the needle is moving. I've seen the needle move over the last couple of years, but I think the posture for most people, especially in the public, it's like they are the worst parent in the world. How could you neglect your children? How do you feel like that for both of you, your heart for biological families, how did that burden kind of just come up in you? It's always tempting to have that adversarial posture, especially when you're working as a CASA advocate. You know, the parents are the problem. What shifted for you to really give you that burden for their care and for their support?
That's a really good question. I think, yeah, it is really hard to walk into situations and be non-judgmental. And I think what I've really had to tell myself is everyone sins. Sin just looks different. And when you know better, you do better. And these parents don't know better. And like Tiffany talked about, the drug use in Wise County starting at a very young age. I mean, that's one of the reasons, honestly, John Reed and I left. We were like, we will not live here. Wise County at one point in the 90s was the highest meth lab per capita in the United States. And so that, I don't know if that statistic is still a thing, but it is high. And we see it everywhere. And so we were just like, we're getting out. We don't want this for ourselves. We want better and we want different. And so being back here, I think we both realized what we were stepping back into, and being able to come at it from just the perspective of we're Christians and we love people and God is the only one that can change hearts. We can help. We can say, hey, here are your services. God wants better for you, has better for you. Life is more fulfilling, but he is ultimately the one that changes hearts. And until people have a relationship with Jesus, those are just empty words and empty promises, right? And so I think Jodri and I having that new perspective, we could step back into Wise County very secure with who we are and knowing that this is a problem and we're going to figure out a way to work through it and to plug into the community and love it where it's at and all of its needs and really, really look at everyone with those eyes, whether, you know, it's a 50-year-old woman or parents that are having their children removed.
Yeah, that's so good. Tiffany, anything that you would add to that?
I think that's one of the hardest battles I fight almost on a, I'm going to say right now on a daily basis. I have a deep defensiveness towards my parents and my mentors. And when someone comes up to me and says, how can you help that mama? And I really have to step back and take a deep breath and remember what God said, what you did to the least of these, you did to me. And he has called every one of us in the service to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And I stop and look at our parents. For example, we had this 1 month second removal. When we were asked to be a mentor for her, we were basically told, we're just kind of going through the motions with this. We're just going to let y'all do this. Don't worry. She's not going to be anymore. Catherine sits on our board, and she was able to sit with the mentor at a first meeting with this mama. And it was hard. She said what we wanted to hear and had a wall up. I'm going to fast forward to where we are now. That was back in October-ish. That mama today is a totally different mom. Even her advocate and the attorney at law were saying, wow, she has changed her life. She sits down with us and has honest, hard conversations. And she learned that she couldn't just check boxes anymore. that she had to actually make changes in her life, and she had to ask for help. And it's one of the biggest things I think parents struggle with, is how to ask for help, and knowing that it's okay to ask for help. We give them that safe space to vent, but also that safe space to ask for that help. And that mom has completely turned. So for us at One Hope Village, that's what it's all about. We took the mom that everybody said, don't waste your time. And we loved her with open arms of Jesus. And today, she is going to have amazing things happen for not just her, but for her child stepping forward. And we have a young mom that came in broken and was like, so overwhelmed, I'm done. And last week she was like, hey, guess what I did? I went to church. And those are the days that I'm like, you know, and just trying to like hold my composure. And then I go back to the time when the person said, how can you help them? And I'm like, that is why we help them, because God has called us to that. And there's so much more in them. They just didn't know it was there, and they didn't know how to ask for it.
I think the asking comes, the ability to ask comes when they are able to trust. I think, Catherine, you mentioned that earlier. When you build trust with someone and you say, hey, it's okay, I'm here to listen, I'm here to be just a guide for you and a help to you, and there is no judgment. When they actually feel, it's one thing to say that you can trust me, right? That trust gets earned through experience. And as you show up over and over and over for them, that trust builds, and things do start to change. I think that we've seen that with kids. We see it also with families. And I think it does give us a lot of hope. I would love to see that continue to multiply over time. Catherine, can you share a little bit about, well, both of you, about the court system? You mentioned, Tiffany, about the judge and the integral role that she has played in just getting One Hope Village off the ground and pioneering you forward. But when you say that they're trauma-informed, or that what changed the court towards becoming trauma-informed, what was the need that really pushed them in that direction? And then what's been the result of that you've seen?
Yeah. So the Children's Commission that kind of started the pilot program, and they reached out to courts in the community and the county and the states and said, okay, apply for it. 5 original courts were chosen for the trauma-informed program. And what we did is each judge that was chosen under it chose their team to work alongside them. I was chosen as a parent engagement liaison for the 8th Regional North Child Protective Court that works under Judge Vaughn, who is our judge. And what we did as a team is each team chose a different aspect to focus on. We chose to focus on a village-style supportive environment that was built around focusing on how do we best help the parent. And Judge Vaughn created this parent binder that we still use. It's a wealth of information in it. It's got resources that we've piled from everywhere. It's got letters from the judge. It's got places for them to keep all of their certifications, their medication logs, almost anything that you can think of. We've tried to give them that space in there. Then all of this went through TDRI training. We had to meet with the Children's Commission once a month to kind of figure out where we are, create a plan, do act, strategic plan on how we're going to live this out. One of the coolest things about my position is what a lot of people don't know is at an adversary hearing, which is the first hearing, parents will come in. They've never seen their attorney. They have no idea what's going on. And what used to happen is you'd walk into the room, CPS is over here, CASA is over here, attorneys are over here, judges at the front, parent walks in, they don't know who anyone is. They are frightened, they're mad, and they just want to shut down. I also have a service dog with me. So Hugo's always with me. He kind of makes things a little easier. But one of the things I do is when a parent comes in or anybody comes in, I'm at the door greeting everyone. And I'm like, hi, how are you? And I find out who they are. And if they have not met their parent, their attorney yet, I take them to meet their attorney and kind of break the ice. And I truly get to be Switzerland in the middle of that. And that's probably one of my favorite things, because they come in so scared, and just when I say, hey, are you CPS or CASA? And to say no, and just to see a breath of like, okay, we might survive this day and it's going to be hard, but getting them interrupted. So one of the things that Judge has done too is CPS can't be on side, CASA can't be on, everybody has to be together. And we don't sit on the stand and testify anymore. Everyone stands in front of Judge in a semicircle. She does the talking. It's not the attorney saying, cross-examining. Judge says, tell me, Mom, tell me what you're doing. Tell me what you're learning. How is it going? Same thing with Dad. And then she'll ask everyone around, CASA, CPS, tell me how they're doing. Focusing really on the good and trying to stay away from the negative, because we know that's in the court reports. And just shifting the trajectory of how things happen in the court, and it has made the parents breathe and has given them ownership on, I want to share the good, but I also want to share the bad. And one of the things that when we're dealing with them, with their mentors, we tell them is, if you need help, don't be afraid to tell Judge, because if CPS isn't doing their job, Judge can make them do their job. Judge can put us all together and say, hey, how do we find these resources? And we work together as a team. And that has been one of the greatest outcomes of it. The project technically ended in last year, but we've continued and we're building the project as we go on through the years.
I think, too, something else to mention is one of the reasons I think our judge decided to really focus on TBRI and to make that the court program is we were seeing a lot of repeat offenders, not just first removal, second or third. And that's something that, I mean, we don't have resources in Wise County. And so seeing the same families over and over again is a strain on resources and is not fixing the problem, right?
Right.
You're continuing to slap people on the wrist and then we'll see you again in a few years. And so I think she really saw that this was not fixing anything. It was just creating more cycles. And in order to break the cycles, she really just had to, you know, stick in the bicycle spoke.
Try something else.
And she has been phenomenal. And that really, I feel like, has happened. I mean, obviously, time will tell more. But with what we're doing with the parents and just the way the court is operating, and it's never going to be 100%, right? People are sinful and things happen. People fall back into the same habits because that's life. And coping is hard. But I think the more we can see less people coming back in, the better it is for everyone, especially these kiddos.
One of the things I think that has helped with the trauma-informed court also is not only are we building family in the courtroom, but one of the things that we're doing at One Hope Village is we're building a family outside of the courtroom. I shared a little bit earlier with Amber, one of my favorite things once a month that we do is called a family dinner. Family is the heart of it. If you are not sitting down to dinner with your family and having those conversations, so many things are being lost and falling through the cracks. So we created a family dinner with our mentors. And that's what we do once a month. We bring in the mentors. We bring in the parents we're working with. We bring in the children. We bring in volunteers. And we literally sit down and we have a meal. And we have some type of workshop that goes along with their service plan. But a lot of times it's just the fellowship at the table. And they walk out. I can't tell you the number that have walked out and said, I love you. And they truly, genuinely know what love means now and know that we love them with everything we have. And they feel loved when they walk out that door. And that's probably one of my favorite parts of that time is just the fellowship and teaching them to sit and rest in each other.
Yeah, it's the power of the healing power of hospitality, I would say. It's being able to be hospitable to whoever comes to the door. That's really, really beautiful. One of the things we say a lot is we want to, as a system, move from this kind of better than nothing mentality. I don't think that that's any one person or one organization's fault that we kind of have lived in this mentality of like better than nothing in this space. There's not enough resources. There's not enough money. There's not enough, you know, to go around. And so we kind of, we're okay with better than nothing rather than excellent care for and hospitality for kids and families. And I think both of you are living examples of that, where you're not okay with the status quo. You really want to provide excellent care and support to these families. And I'm just excited to see more and more people stepping into it. Why, you've mentioned a little bit about this, but why do you do it? And then where do we go from here? Where do you guys go from here? And where do you feel like the system goes from here?
Why do we do it? I think it just goes back to that burden. And if we're not doing it, who is? And there's that call, because there's not a lot happening in Wise County that someone has to step in and do it. And we have the resources and we have enough love to spread around to be able to do that and to open that side of us, because, you know, it is not all rosy and sunshine in CASA cases or in One Hope Village even. It won't always be. But being able to hold that tension and to be able to bear that, you know, it's not always going to be perfect, but it is always beautiful, because God redeems and has, I mean, he's redeemed us. And so he sends us out and calls us to do that for others and to help others in that. And so, I mean, that's really... Also, Amber, you know my background. Tiffany knows my background. But like, I was raised in an abusive home, and I was raised with a really horrible father. And I think being able to change the trajectory of people's lives, like, Jesus is the only reason my life is not what my parents' life was. And so being able to know that and walk in that blessing and not take that for granted really allows me, like, fresh eyes to see people and to know that, like, they don't know what they're doing, because they would do better if they knew better, like I said earlier. And so really, like, John Reed and I have changed the trajectory of our family tree, but that's not enough, because we can help others too. And so being able to dig in and do that is really why I do what I do.
Yeah, that's so good. Tiffany, what about you?
Kind of similar. I grew up with a very alcoholic, abusive father. And I'm still probably one of the stubbornest people are. But God gave each one of those gifts. My gift is definitely a fighter. And sometimes people do not know how to fight for themselves. And over the years, each of the positions that God has put me into, I've learned that I'm continually fighting. I fight less angrily now and less hot-headed now, but I had to get to this point so that I can fight for the parents. And I fight for them because someone fought for me. My husband and I, just to be honest, when we got engaged, my biological dad said, "You'll never make it." And I stayed 10 years in the first 10 years of our marriage was very volatile, very hard, but I wasn't about to let him win, my biological dad. And so I stayed there, and someone stepped into Mike and I's life and literally grabbed us by the hands and said, "Hey, it doesn't have to be like this. When you put God right in the middle of your life, it's going to be totally different." And if someone hadn't stepped in and taken our hand and walked us out of that trench, we wouldn't be here 25 years later. We've been married 25 years. We've been together 27. And beautiful daughters and grandchild. We wouldn't be here. So my story and life isn't my story of struggle. It's God's giving me the tools to do his work, to help grab those hands, walk him out of the trenches, sometimes drag him out of the trenches and say, "Hey, I'm not here with you. And there is a better way. God is a better way, and he's waiting right there for us. All we have to do is take one..." I tell my parents this a lot. "I just need you to put one foot down. One toe, actually. If you will just put one toe down, I'll pull you the rest of the way till we get to that line." And some have to be pulled a little harder, but some will put 10 toes down and slowly start moving. And so for me, it's the person that stepped in and said, "Hey guys, there's something better, and it's Jesus." And that's all I want people to see when they see us, One Hope Village, when they see me, is they see Jesus, and that's why it's going to be better.
Yeah, it's the what's been done for me, I can do for others, right? It's so beautiful. Well, thank you both for the work that you're doing. Thank you for spending some time with me today and sharing your story. We just hope that you continue it. Stay in touch. I'm sure that we will stay in touch. But thank you again for sharing your story and for doing the work that you do every day.
Thank you.
To those listening, we hope these conversations have inspired you to find your place along the river. And we welcome you to join us in bringing hope and renewal to the city of Houston. If you'd like more information on how to get involved, please visit riversideproject.org and submit a contact form. We'll see you next time.